Hey y'all, this is Sam and this is Crimology. This is episode 146. Before we get started, just the housekeeping stuff. Make sure you follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Both are at Crimology Pod. We've got an email that's crimologypod@gmail.com. Send us literally anything, comments, questions, concerns, suggestions, all of that good stuff over there. Obviously, on Instagram, we're posting pictures, and then on Facebook, I post our source material links that I use. And so if sometimes I reference different like manifestos this week, I'll talk about journal entries. So I post websites that'll take you to those journal entries or anything like that. So make sure you just go look at all that over on our Facebook page. Make sure to give us 5 stars, subscribe, share, do all of those things. So let's get started into this week's episode. This is episode 146, Susan Powell. This week's state is Utah. Other cases that we've already covered for this state are Elizabeth Smart, Ted Bundy, and Lauren Mikulski. So just some fun facts, because we are without Stephen again this week. Utah is the second driest state. Arizona is the first, and then Utah second. Its nickname is the Beehive State, and their state bird is the California gull, which Google what this bird looks like, but it's like the most common beach bird. Like, think of a beach bird, think of a beach gull, and that's what this bird is. So I just thought it was funny that, like, to think of a beach bird, having it be this state bird of the second driest place in the world. Anyways, I just thought it was funny. And then Utah is known for its skiing and the Sundance Film Festival that happens there. Oh, I think in either January or February, so it just happened. I don't like the snow or the cold, but I have seen pictures of Utah. I've seen people on TikTok who live in Utah, and so they brag about their skiing and just the beauty of Utah. So I definitely want to go, but want to enjoy it from the comfort of a warm home. So anyways, that's Utah, and that's this week's state. So this week, we're talking about the disappearance and presumed death of Susan Powell. So Susan had a pretty normal and easy childhood. Her family was very active in their LDS religion, which is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the church is how she actually met her husband, Joshua Powell. The two met at an LDS religion class in November of 2000, and by April of 2001, they were married. They went on to have 2 kids together, Charles and Braden, and they looked like the perfect all-American family. After the couple got married, they moved in with Joshua's father, Stephen, for a couple of years. Stephen started to become kind of obsessed with Susan. He installed cameras all over the house, so he would watch her from room to room, just watched her constantly everywhere she went, including inside the bathroom. He then started stealing her underwear. He would start reading her journals, and then basically to kind of jump to another point in Susan's journals. Obviously, that's where you go when you spill your deep, dark secrets, right? And so you talk about problems that you're having in your relationship. And so then what he would do is she would write, like, I wish Joshua would do this. And then Stephen would do that, like, basically trying to get Susan to like him rather than his son. Weird dynamic. And then in 2003, Stephen came to Susan and professed his feelings to her, and she obviously rejected him. And then after this, the couple moved out of Stephen's house to try to put some distance there. Now, after the move, when we look at Susan's journal entries, this is really when it starts to show that her relationship with Joshua didn't improve any after the move. If anything, it got worse. She wrote about how Joshua refused to go to church with the family and how this really upset her. And she also wrote about how Joshua still kept in frequent contact with her father, even after everything he did to her, and how she just felt like this was weird. Like, if your dad's looking at me around the house and, like, he just said that he has feelings for me, like, you would think that you would feel some type of way, but the fact that you're still just, like, chatting it up with your dad, she just felt like it was weird. And then after her disappearance, some of Susan's friends said that Joshua was very controlling in their relationship, and that Susan talked about how he often spent an outrageous amount of money. And then in 2007, Joshua filed for bankruptcy. And he declared over $200,000 in debt. Now, when we look back on previous relationships that Joshua had, there was two that I can find that were mentioned from when Joshua was in college. In kind of the first relationship, Joshua and the girl moved in together. And that girl talked about how Joshua wouldn't let her go and hang out with her family alone. How he was very controlling in that sense of, like, wouldn't let her go out on her own because somebody may say something to you and pull you away from me or whatever. And so basically what happened is she went on a trip with her friends alone, basically behind Joshua's back. And then when she got there, she was like having a girl chat with her friends. And then she decided just to not return to Utah. And she broke up with Joshua or with Joshua over the phone and said, "I'm not coming back to Utah. Like, you're too much." And so then that's how they broke up. And then his second relationship just kind of said the same thing, that he was just very controlling, not really physically aggressive, like wasn't anything physical. It was just a lot of very controlling, and then it's kind of verbal, like, "Oh, so you don't care about me if you don't do this." So he's very manipulative in his relationships that he's had even before Susan. And then after that second relationship ended is when he met Susan, and then they got married soon after. In 2008, Susan records a video of some property damage that Joshua apparently did. And after she recorded this video, she went and secretly wrote a secret will that said there was extreme turmoil in their marriage, and that, quote, "If I die, it may not be an accident, even if it looks like one." And so there's one diary entry that I'll upload onto Instagram and Facebook that says kind of this, where it's like, even if it looks like an accident, like, this, it probably isn't an accident. Like, I'm worried for my children. There's also around this same year, so in 2008, it's just a picture of it, but it basically says, like, "This journal is for my family and my friends and my boys, but it is not for my husband because I am afraid of him." And so it's just very clear. She writes it out very clear, this fear that she has for Joshua. So jumping to December 6th of 2009, Susan, Charles, and Braden go to church that morning. They come home, everything's fine, the same Sunday routine. And then even that afternoon, a neighbor comes over to visit the family. She stays for a while, and then she reports leaving the house around 5 p.m. This neighbor is the last person outside of the Powell family to see Susan alive. The next day, Joshua's mom and Joshua's sister, they're trying to get a hold of the family. They find out that Susan didn't show up for work that morning and that both of the boys hadn't been dropped off at daycare that morning either. When they aren't able to get a hold of either Susan or Joshua, they go to the house. They're calling on the phone. They're knocking at the door. They don't get an answer at any of them. So they decide to make the decision to call police. Well, police are able to break down the door and they're able to get into the house. But when they do, they don't find anyone at home. Susan's purse, her wallet, her ID, and her phone are all still at home. The only weird thing that they noticed was that there was two box fans pointed at a wet spot on the couch. But like other than this, like there was nothing, no sign of distress, like no kind of anything in the house. So this was kind of the only thing that was out of place. So they go through that day trying to look for anything that they can, still trying to get a hold of Joshua and Susan, and they're not finding anything. And then about 5 p.m. that night, Joshua pulls into the family home with both of his boys in the back seat of their van, but Susan isn't with them. And when they pull in and Susan's not with them, Joshua is immediately brought in for questioning. He tells officers that around midnight, he packed the car and took his two boys on a camping trip, and that he left Susan at home sleeping. He described the camping area that he took the boys to, and then when police go back to the area that Joshua claimed to be at, they didn't recognize anything that he was talking about. And so what I mean by this is, he was like, oh, we stayed at, like, Sparrowhawk, I don't even think you can camp over there, but anyways, like, we camped over at Sparrowhawk Mountain, like, you know, we camped over there, and there was this one place that we stayed at, and there's a bathroom right over to the side of us, and if you looked at the mountain, like, this way, you could see this tree in the distance, you know, just like, he's describing the area that they were at. And when police get there, they found the area where Joshua claimed to be, but it was like minor details like that. Like if Joshua was like, oh, we stayed in this area and there's a bathroom right over there, there like wouldn't be a bathroom right over there, or there wouldn't be a parking place right there. So it was like minor details. Like you got the vague of the description. So like where you obviously knew a little bit about the area, but you were missing specific details, or specific details you gave just weren't there, if that makes any sense. So this was kind of the first thing that police were like, okay, you're like kind of describing it, but you're not describing it. So like, we've got more questions. So like, were you really there kind of thing? And now I'm not saying that people don't go camping in the freezing weather, because it happens. But why would you decide to go camping at midnight? Why would that be the time that you're like, oh yeah, I think it's a great time now to leave to go camping? So I looked up just what the average weather in Utah in December of 2008 would be. And just the average was 27 degrees. And then obviously it was going to the single digits at night. I think I saw that the average was 4 degrees at night and 27 degrees during the day. So not also, you know, so they're from Utah, so they're probably used to it. You know, they probably have all of the stuff to keep them warm. So I'm not saying that like that's weird to an extent. It's weird for me, but not weird to like everybody else. But it's leaving at midnight. Like, why would you leave at midnight when your kids are sleeping? You know what I mean? So it's, that was also kind of the second kind of thing for police to be like, interesting. Joshua also told police that he kept thinking that it was Sunday and that it wasn't Monday. So he didn't think to call his boss and tell him that he wasn't coming into work, or to call his daycare and tell him that the kids wouldn't be in, because he kept thinking that it was Sunday, which is another one of those that I was like, okay, I guess I can understand. But it's like one of the three questions we have about like, where did you camp? Why did you leave at midnight? And why didn't you tell anybody about it? I guess your, I thought it was Sunday, like, does help one of those three questions. After a search of the house is done, they find drops of Susan's blood on the floor. They also find a handwritten letter from Susan expressing that she had very fear for her life. And they also find a $1.5 million life insurance policy for Susan. So this is all we have right now. But for days after Susan's disappearance, Joshua starts to act weirder than normal. He liquidates his wife's retirement accounts. He withdraws his kids from daycare. And then he cancels all of Susan's future and regular appointments. So she had a regular chiropractor appointment that she kept. He like canceled all of those and said, nope, she doesn't need them anymore. She won't need them anymore. And just all of these things that you wouldn't do if you knew your wife was coming back. So like right at this point, the general public is thinking, okay, she's just missing. But then he does all of these things like you're not liquidating your wife's retirement accounts if you have hope that she's coming back one day. You know what I mean? So it's just all of these things that you're like, hello, red flags everywhere. When police decided to make the decision to talk to the children, Charlie did confirm that they did go camping that night that Susan went missing. But he said that Susan went with them to the camping site, but that she didn't come back with them. And then a couple weeks later, Charlie told his teacher at school that his mom was dead. While Brayden was at daycare, he drew a picture of three people in their family van. He said that it was him, his brother, and his dad. But he said his mom wasn't in the drawing because she was in the trunk of the car. Now, obviously, this is one of those things where, like, kids say the darnest things, right? And so you can't really hold on to this and you can't. We've had kids who have testified and we've had kids who have played a major part in crimes. And so the fact that Charlie is saying these things and Brayden's doing these things, so you know that there's something there. But they're also kids, so you can't, like, I don't know. I guess I should have Googled this. I didn't think about this right now. I don't know if kids can be a reliable source. I mean, they do testify. Anyways, that's a good question. So they've got this information from the two boys, but how far can you go with that information? And after all of this, Joshua acting weird and the kids making comments like this, the police announce that they are going to bring Joshua in for questioning again. But 2 days after this, after police announced this, on December 14th, Joshua lawyers up. And so they don't get the real kind of questioning that police were wanting. And then a few days later, Joshua moves him and his kids back in with his father. Now, Joshua's father kept saying that Susan left, or the whole family, not just the father, the whole family kept saying that Susan left because she was struggling with mental health issues and that she ran away with another man. I forget who it was, and I should have written it down, but there was like another man in the state or in the area who had also gone missing around this time. And so it was a big thing that Joshua and his brothers and his dad would say, oh, Susan and that other guy who went missing were in an affair together, and so they ran off together, and that's where they both are. And just like kind of, I guess, grasping at straws. Susan's family said they had no idea why Joshua's family was saying these things. And then Joshua's family would point to the journals a lot, and they kept just pointing to the journals to show that Joshua and his family were right. I said that we have clips of Susan's journal. The whole journal has not obviously been publicized. I've seen pictures how there are multiple journals, like a dozen journals. So I doubt that they're ever really going to be published, but it was always like that's basically what Joshua leaned on, is every time Joshua was questioned about it, he'd basically say, just look at the journals. If the judge released the journals, like all of the questions would be answered. And you're like, well, why can't you answer any of the questions? So it was just like, they'd be like, all of your information's in the journal. And they're like, but you can't tell us, like, we've got to read it. So again, just weird. Shortly after Susan's disappearance, Joshua's brother Michael sold his car. So police decide, since we really don't have anything, let's just go look at the car, just in case there just so happens to be something in there. Like, let's just go see if that leads to anything. They ended up bringing cadaver dogs with them, and the dogs indicated that decomposing human remains had been in the trunk of the vehicle. But when a DNA test was done, that test came back inconclusive. And so I think that's the perfect example of this case, is where it seems like you're getting a little bit of information and you're like, okay, this looks good. And then there's something that, like, you turn around and you're like, okay, but that doesn't really help us. And so, like, with these cadaver dogs, you're like, okay, well then, like, that's the ticket, right? But then the DNA comes back inconclusive. And so you're like, okay. With Charlie and Brayden coming and saying, nope, my mom was there, and, like, my mom's now dead, and this is what happens. And you're like, okay, oh, no, okay. But then they're kids, and then they turn around and they say something like, yeah, and my dad broke my arm at the same time. And you're like, okay, no, that didn't happen. So, like, they're kids. And so I feel like that's how this story has gone, is you get a little bit, and then you take, like, three steps back because you're like, okay, but that doesn't really help anything because we aren't able to justify that, if that makes any sense. So then on September 22nd, a search was done at Steven's house, where officials found an alarming amount of child pornography. So Steven was arrested, and then Susan's parents immediately filed for custody of Charles and Brayden when they found out about all of this. And then the court granted Susan's parents temporary custody of the boys, saying that Joshua needed to move out of his father's house in order to get custody back. So Joshua does this, and then after Joshua goes through protocols and he has to go through evaluations, the initial recommendation was that Joshua have visitation with his children several times a week with a social worker present. Now, just to add to the crazy of this story, and none of this is proven, it's just always been speculated, but it was assumed that Joshua and Michael created different websites, or they would post different things about Susan and where she was. And so this was what I was talking about the other guy who went missing in the area. And all of a sudden, now there's rumors that Susan and him are together and had an affair, and now they ran off together. It was always assumed that Joshua and Michael created these things themselves. They would post about how she ran off. They posted that Susan's parents were abusive and they were neglecting the children while they were in their custody. And they're just doing all of these weird, like, acting like other people on different accounts, which is why none of this has ever been confirmed and probably won't ever be confirmed. But it was just to add another layer to the crazy. Then on February 5th, 2012, the boys go with a social worker named Elizabeth to visit Joshua. Soon after they get to the home, Elizabeth calls police because when Joshua answered the door, he grabbed the two boys, drug them inside the house, and refused to allow Elizabeth inside. And then, a little while later, the house blows up, killing all three boys inside. The case was immediately treated as a murder-suicide because the scene started looking deliberate. When the bodies were examined, they found chopping injuries around the boys' heads and the boys' necks, and the cause of death for all three of them were carbon monoxide poisoning. And then when they looked at the crime scene, when they were able to get in there, they noticed that there was, like, an axe type of equipment next to where Joshua's body was found. So the assumption is that Joshua was trying to kill Charlie and Brayden, but the carbon monoxide got to him before he was actually able to do it, and he passed out from it. Officials also found evidence that gasoline had been spread around the whole house, with gallons of drums of gasoline outside of the home. And then after the death, friends and relatives of Joshua's came forward and said that minutes before the deaths, he had sent them emails saying goodbye. He had mentioned how they could get into various accounts of his, how to turn the utility off, and basically, like, here's what to do after I'm gone. Love you so much. Bye. And that he had sent various emails to various different people. And then it was also found out that Michael was named the beneficiary of Joshua's accounts. Now, the day before the death, Joshua also was donating a lot of stuff. He was donating children's clothes, toys, books, his clothes, furniture. He's like donating all of this stuff. He's then moving money around in various accounts. One article said that he took $7,000 out in cash. I don't know what you would need to take out in cash to do right before you're planning to kill yourself. But like, he's doing all of these things. So that also goes into this premeditated, you knew what you were going to do when you're donating all of this stuff and you're doing all of these things right before it happens. Now, when Stephen was informed of the deaths, he didn't seem surprised or sad about the situation. The only emotion that was registered, it seemed like anger, and it was at the guards who gave him this information. And then he goes quiet. He doesn't say anything after this point. So from when Stephen finds out that the boys are dead, he basically doesn't say anything. So then, February 11th, 2013, a little after a year after the deaths of the boys, Michael, Joshua's brother, kills himself by jumping from a roof of a parking garage. He had been questioned a lot since the deaths because Stephen had refused to answer. But because they weren't getting answers from Stephen, or they weren't getting him to talk at all, they were turning a lot to Michael. And because Michael was being put into a situation to answer a lot more questions, this is what is assumed brought Michael to make this decision too. The investigation into Susan's disappearance was closed on May 21st of 2013, with many people trying to get officials to mark Susan legally dead, with the cause of death being homicide. And so this is one of those cases that we, I also want to say, in 2013, I know for sure that Steve and Joshua's father passed away. And I want to say it was also 2013, but that could have been wrong. So this is also one of those cases that it's literally, we may never know whatever happened to Susan, because now everybody involved in this case, assuming also Susan, is dead and has passed away. So this is one of those where you're like, we may never ever know what happened in this case, because literally everybody is gone now. And so with Utah, I had a hard time finding a case because, like I said, we've done the top three for this case or for this state. And so I was having a hard time finding it. And I say this every single week because I saw this name and I was like, okay, I guess this is what we'll do. And so I started writing, and then it was like, whoa. And you're like, what? And you're like, what? And so there's just so many twists and turns to this episode that I think it turned into a good one. And so it was one of those that, even though we've done the top three for this case, this also was a really good one. So it was good and it was long, and I talked for way too long. So let's get out of here. like always, Instagram, Facebook, email, 5 stars, review, give us all of those things. Thank you guys so much for continuing to listen, to just me right now. But thank you guys so much for your support. This is episode 146. Like always, this is Sam, and this is Crimology.